Welcome back. We are now going to be learning the next section in Tanakh, which is called Making the Mikdash. So just to appreciate how much we've done so far, we've already in this year, we've already covered the first five prakim of Melachim Aleph. That's a very significant achievement in terms of just the content and trying to put it all together. Our next section leads us from essentially the last end of Perek Hay all the way to halfway through Perek Tes. Why halfway through prakim? Because the chapter headings weren't given to us by Jews. They were added by Christians much later. And they don't always thematically connect. This is a new section now because we've left behind now Shlomo's achievements. Now we're moving into his magnum opus, the greatest achievement Shlomo HaMelech or perhaps any human being has ever contributed to world history, which is creating a Dira Batachtonim, a space for Hashem in this world. And we're going to have a lot of questions as we read about this, because anything we've learned up till now about the Mishkan and what it looks like is going to be dramatically different to what Shlomo creates. And one of the questions I want to put out there before we even start is, why or did Shlomo do this? What license did he have to change the tzura, the form of this abode, as it was from what we saw in the desert? That's going to be a very important question for us to think about as we see this, because it's going to be not just difference in terms of size and magnitude, but it's going to be difference in terms of numbers, space, how many kelim, what kelim. It's going to be extremely different. And the purpose also sounds like it's going to be somewhat different when we listen to Shlomo's prayer at the end. So there's a lot to learn about. Our focus this evening is going to be a little more humble because we need to get into it. And that is in order to get to build a magnificent structure like this, you need to have supplies. So our discussion this evening is going to be focused around the end of Perek Hay, and this is really focusing on the alliance between Tyre and Jerusalem. That's our starting point to be able to understand the geopolitics and the economics necessary to create the base of Mikdash. That's our starting point. So what we're going to do is we're going to have less psukim to follow through and a little more, actually we're going to learn a little bit more inside in terms of some of the background and the history of this period. So let's start at the very beginning. We're going to look at the psukim which run from Perek Hay, Psukim Tezvov, all the way to Psukim Chof Hay. So it's going to be our first 11 Psukim, which is going to be guiding us this evening. So here we have it. We're told, Vayishlach Chiram Melech Tzor, Es Avodove Shlomo. Chiram, the king of Tzor, sends his servants to Shlomo. Ki Shoma, ki Oysoi Moshchu Lemelech Tachas Ovihu, ki Oyhev Hoya Chiram LeDavid Kol Yamim. We know that Chiram loved David all his days, and when he hears that Shlomo has taken his seat, he sends messengers. Vayishlach Shlomo el Chiram lemor, and Shlomo responds by sending messengers to him. Ato yodata es David avi ki lo yachol livnois bayis l'shem Hashem elokav mipnei hamilchama asher sevavuhu. That David was not able to make the sanctuary because of all the troubles which surrounded him. Ad teis Hashem oisom tachas kapois raglai, until God gave them under my feet. By the way, you'll notice that the word feet over there is in parentheses as to how to word that. Now, the unvowels, the unparentheses version is ragloi, which means his feet. The one that is actually red, which is the one which is also called a kri uksiv, which means that if you look at the actual Tanakh text, the parchment as it is written, you will see it written ragloi with a vav at the end, which means his feet. But the way we read it is raglai, which means my feet. So just to understand what's the tension there in those, what's being communicated in those two pronouns. Until God gave all the enemies under his mine feet. Which means, in a certain sense, I am now the all-powerful one, but I'm only the all-powerful one because of my father, because God allowed him to quell all the enemies. So there's a little bit of a dynamic that he's sort of addressing there, whether it be the spoken or the subliminal messaging that he's trying to convey, which is, that's why there are kriyoksivs when there's complex messages which are being conveyed. That's what he seems to be saying to Chiram, because Shlomo was not the one who conquered these enemies. And now Hashem has allowed for me, anybody around me, ein satan ve'ein pegara, there's no critiques on the or those who are persecuting us, and there's no pegara, there's no negative plagues or attackers. The Mefarshim said that means from the outside and from the inside. Shlomo Melech has done away with political dissidents. He's done away with enemies on the outside. Everything is peaceful on the home and the external front. And I want to make a house for God, my God. Kasher diber Hashem al David avi lemor, as Hashem spoke to my father, saying, your son, who will sit on the throne, will buy, build a house in my name. And now cut for me cedars from the Lebanon. I will send servants to be intermingled with your servants. And I will pay the amount of your servants necessary. No one knows how to cut down wood like those people from Sidon. So I'm going to send my cohort. You train them. I'll pay for your training. When he hears about this, he's very happy. Wow! Blessed be God, he gave David such a fantastic successor who's so wise of this great nation. I've heard what your message was. I will give everything you want with the woods you're demanding. My servants will bring the wood down from the sea. And the way they translate it over here in Pasuk Chof Gimel is they will send them into rafts by sea, and they will take them until the place which you will tell me. And in response to that, you are going to give me food for my household. And he would supply all the cypress and the cedar to the degree that Shlomo wanted. Shlomo nosan lechiram esrim elef kor kritim, and he provided in response 20,000 kor, as a measure of wheat, mil makoles leveisoy the esrim kor shemen kosis. And he gives a certain amount of oil, koyiten shlomo lechiram shana b'shana, and that's what he provided for him on an annual basis. So this is the trade deal which has been arranged between these two kingdoms. So there's a lot. This is just to stop here for a moment. We have a fantastic alliance. When things are going well, things go well for everybody. In trade, it's a win-win situation. Tyre is getting food, Israel is getting wood, and everybody seems to be winning in this arrangement. So there's a few things to think about over here, and just a few basic backgrounds is usually when we read Tanakh, and certainly the way I was schooled to read Tanakh, we look for all the information in the Pesukim that we have in front of us, and that is sometimes helpful, but there is more to this. Who is Hiram? What is Tyre? Where are we? What stage of development of the world are we at? So let's take a little bit of a background into what this is. Tyre is actually part of a kingdom called, does anybody know what the name of that kingdom was? It ultimately merged into what we know as Phoenicia. Okay, so the two strong posts of this nation were Tyre and Sidon, which are found on the coast of what we have today as Lebanon. These are two very mighty trading posts. In fact, at their height, they controlled the trade of the Mediterranean Sea. Because if you take a look, I just put a map on the first page here in the sources, you can see where Sidon and Tyre are. They're essentially at the center point of the end bay of the basin of the Mediterranean, which means they command essentially the entire coast. Whether they go northwards, southwards, they can control all the access to Greece, all the way through Crete, Sicily, Italy, Sardinia, Northern Africa. This is essentially the greatest trade route, which was controlled by this nation, Phoenicia, the great tradesman. And this nation did succeed very strong as a very strong nation for many, many years. And in fact, the Tyre itself, I actually unfortunately did not put an actual map of the city of Tyre itself. Tyre was primarily an island. So Tyre was an island just off the coast of Lebanon, as we have Lebanon today, which also made it almost impenetrable. It had a mainland extension, but it made it impenetrable so much so that when Alexander the Great was fighting against the Near East, it took him 13 years of siege to conquer Tyre. 13 years, the great Greek armies could not conquer it. And the only way they were able to conquer it was not by the fleets at sea, but by slowly destroying Usha, which was the landmass of Tyre, and destroying and putting, essentially making a land bridge for his war machines to go across. Which now today, Tyre is accessible through a land bridge because of originally that initial land bridge was created by Alexander the Great to conquer Tyre. Very, very powerful nation that existed. And this, at this point in time, this alliance between Israel in the south and Tyre in the north was a very powerful moment. Just to understand this, there were a number of people who fought against Tyre, including Nebuchadnezzar in the rise of the Babylonians. What is interesting as well about this city is that one of its main exports was actually dye. And so it's fascinating that along the seacoast right there were a lot of these shells of the murex, and they would actually export this very expensive dye off the Mediterranean coast to the rest of the known world, purple dye, blue dye, all these things. And of course, this relates to the whole discussion of Tcheles and Argamon, which we're going to see as the colors or the royal colors, which are seen in this area. And it is interesting, of course, that we call this area, the export that Shlomo is looking for primarily is Arzei HaLevanon, which means the cedars of Lebanon, and that appears all over in Tanakh. When we talk about strength and a pillar of power, we refer to it as an Erez, as a cedar, and the Erez is specifically in Lebanon. In fact, Shlomo's own house is going to be called, as you'll soon see, is going to be called Ya'ar HaLevanon. It's going to be made out of paneled of cedar wood. And it is also fascinating today is what is the flag today of the country Lebanon? I actually just put it at the bottom of the page over here. Is a red stripe at the bottom, a red stripe at the top, and a green tree in the middle. That's the Erez HaLevanon. That's the cedar of Lebanon, right? Which is demonstrated. It's even today is sort of seen as the icon of the country north of us in Lebanon. Of course, Israel stretched further north in the times of Tanakh than it does today necessarily, even further up towards the Litani River. Nonetheless, we're not going to get into geopolitics and the complications that we have today. But this seems to be, this is a little bit of the background. Let's take it one step further as well. And that is in terms of trying to understand who Hiram himself was, we have an interesting introduction already. We have this relationship codified already in Shmuel Beis when David HaMelech becomes king. We're told that at the very beginning there, this is in source 3, Vayishlach Hiram Melech Tzor Malachim El David Vatzei Arazim V'Chorshei Eitz V'Chorshei Even Kir Vayivnu Bayis LeDavid. So when David ascended the throne and became the united king of Israel, at that point, Hiram, knowing where his bread was going to be buttered, sent down cedar wood, and then he sent artisans of how to carve the stones, how to file the wood. Vayeda David ki heichino Hashem lemelech al Yisrael v'chi nisei mamlachtoi ba'avur amo Yisrael. At this point, David knew that he was divinely ordained to be the king of Israel. Fascinating. When do you know that you've been chosen? Is sometimes when your neighbor leans in and says you're special. We saw a similar kind of thing. The Me'ah Shiloh points out about Avram Avinu, in all the complications he has in his life, when suddenly Avimelech walks over from Gerar, from the area of Gaza, and says, Elokim imcho b'chol asher atah aseh, you know, Abraham, I notice you're special, God is with you in everything you do. Sometimes when a pagan king looks in and says, you know, you're special, there's something about you, that's a very validating. Now there's a, we'll call the Shem Ulatiferis, where this Or Lagoyim, so to speak, when the rest of the nations look in, this is what happened to David. This was one of the crowning moments of David HaMelech, got the imports from his neighbors. And this relationship was solidified well back, which is why we're now following on intergenerational. Now we have Hiram relating to his son also in a very endearing manner. It sounds like it was for free. Right, so it's interesting that Shlomo was the one who initiated this request and the offer. We're going to see as well, as we follow this through, when we get to Perek Tes, Shlomo is going to offer him more. He's going to offer him 20 cities in the Galilee. And Hiram is not going to be so excited. He doesn't feel that they're at the grade that he was expecting after his contribution. So there is a little bit of tension. But that started off, it sounds like, in a very good place. And it seems that, in general, the temperature was pretty good most of the time through. There is more to this relationship. And that's if we reach outside of Tanakh as well. There are other indicators as to what's going on in this relationship. Here's an example of this. Here's what Josephus says in Antiquities about the relationship of Israel and Tyre. Fascinating. He has a whole paragraph on this relationship. And he says the following. He says also that Solomon, who was then king of Jerusalem in source 4, sent riddles to Hiram and desired to receive the like from him, but that he who could not solve them should pay money to them that did solve them, and that Hiram accepted the conditions, and when he was not able to solve the riddles proposed by Solomon, he paid a great deal of money for his fine, but that afterwards did solve the proposed riddles by means of Abdemon, a man of Tyre, that Hiram proposed other riddles, which when Solomon could not solve, he paid back a great deal of money to Hiram. That is what Dios wrote. Fascinating. So there seems to be not just a trade relationship, there seems to be also the meeting of minds to a certain degree, which we're going to see by other kingdoms soon. Amidst the Shem, which we'll once get later on also to Perek Ches and Tes, we're going to see the other nations looking in, and Shlomo HaMelech being this sage that are of renown. And there's this interaction, we'll call it this intellectual trade, so to speak, which is going on over here. This is not just gambling. This is the exchange of ideas, which is being developed in this corner of the world. This is something you do not see in nations which are emerging and nations which are struggling to exist. You don't see the exchange of ideas. You just see survival tactics. This is beyond survival. This is already, as we've seen, the emergence into the state of Israel, the nation of Israel, in a much grander. A grander description. It is interesting that I just put a picture below on page 2. That's the tomb of Hiram, Hiram the First. So it's not so easy as a Jew today to go visit necessarily. Lebanon is a little bit of a hotbed, and still northern Lebanon is a little safer than southern Lebanon. But unfortunately, we live in complicated times. If anybody's had a chance to read, I recommended the other day, Pumpkin Flowers, by Marty Freeman. It's a really worthwhile read, very fascinating book about his time he did in Lebanon in the tour before Israel retracted their troops, and how he went back to visit it on his Canadian passport and his trips through Lebanon. Very, very fascinating. But nonetheless, it's like Israel in some ways is a modern country with incredibly ancient roots, but the problem is that they also have an insurgency. So that makes things much more complicated. But be it as it may, so this is that you can actually visit the tomb of Hiram, the one that we're talking about over here. And let's dig a little deeper. What I'm not going to spend so much time on this evening is that there is actually a parallel narrative to ours in Direi HaYamim. And we're going to start seeing this more and more, that when we're reading Melachim, we really need to actually read the parallel narrative in Direi HaYamim, which recounts or omits the same account, and tries to see the differences between the two, what the one adds to the other. One thing which it does add, and we're not going to get into the details now, but one thing which is we are going to see is that in the version 2, which is later on, he doesn't just ask for wood, he also asks for artisans. He asks for people who are going to train the Israelites how to have the crafts. He's talking to an agrarian culture, to a society of farmers who are now going to create a metropolis. So you need to have different skill sets. So he's going to talk to the city builders, the metropolis builders of the age, which are the Phoenicians. And that's who he's going to bring in. It's fascinating why there's a difference over here. What is omitted in Direi HaYamim happens to be that this first reach out of Hiram. Why was Hiram first reaching out to Shlomo? First, there's three letters, right? There's Hiram to Shlomo, Shlomo to Hiram, and Hiram back. So there's three interchanges here. What was the first reaching out of Hiram to David, to Shlomo probably about?
Congratulations.
Could be congratulations, and also on the flip side of that, Nichum Avelim. But his father passed away, so it's likely there's a Mephoshim say. He said that, you know, I respected your father, I'm paying homage, and welcome to the throne. What a wonderful son! And that was it. It was just a diplomatic statesmanship which was necessary. And then Shlomo Melech dived into the next step, which was. What was trade, and that's what we see following on. That part isn't mentioned in Direi HaYamim. Okay, we're not going to spend so much time on that. Right now, the Rabbanel enumerates three specific differences and has two columns of discussion as to all the differences. We're not going to follow that right now. Quick question. When we looked through this text just a moment ago, did Hiram accept the terms that Shlomo asked for in this trade agreement? Did he accept the terms which were proposed? So let's see what Shlomo asked for. Let's see what Hiram accepted to do. we go back to that text for a moment. And the truth is, what do you say, yes or no?
Partial.
Did he? So,
yeah.
Partial?
Partial.
Okay. So what did Shlomo HaMelech offer? What was his offer? He says, Shlomo's deal was, I will, what's he going to provide and what's he going to get? Shlomo's going to provide workers and money. So I'm going to send my team, my cohorts up north. I'm going to pay your team to work with them and we'll bring back the wood. What does Hiram offer as a counter proposal?
The wood.
We'll send the wood downstream. Right, by the way, why downstream? Because it's much easier to transport over sea than over land. Tyre is on the sea. Israel has ports. Much easier to deal with than dealing over land, especially when you're talking about very heavy equipment that is going downstream. So this it sounds like Hiram, just without doing too much investigation over here, Hiram seems to want, what's he protecting? Right, he wants to have sovereignty over his art. Right, the way we cut down our cedars, how and where we get them from, the seeds perhaps to the trees themselves is something we want to have control over. And so, therefore, in this trade, we're going to provide. We're not going to invite teams in. It's interesting. In a much later iteration, when coffee was first discovered, it was fascinating. I once went to an exhibit just on coffee. And when coffee was discovered, there was a few different places it was discovered. One of the reasons they discovered was they found that the goats always jumpy a little bit after they ate from that bush. Okay, anyways, but nonetheless, they found, so there was actually under the, I believe it was the Ottoman Empire that had at a certain point had control over it. So they would search people leaving the kingdom so they would not be carrying coffee beans because they wanted to have a monopoly on the trade. They didn't want anybody going home to their natural country and planting their local Colombian roast. So the countries want to have sovereignty over their assets. Now, if they're going to bring their tradesmen in, what's going to happen? So you know, they're going to first of all know the trade, know the arts, and perhaps even steal some of the wherewithal to be able to replicate. That's the way it works. You know, I have an uncle who is an electrical engineer, and he was employed by China at a certain point to design a smelter. Now, a smelter is not a little dinky pot. A smelter is a 30-story smelter, which essentially takes iron ore and turns it into liquid metal. And so, once they designed it, the Chinese had them design it as an international company. They took the smelter to China, they took it all apart, and they replicated another 5 of them. That's how it works, right? So, what Hiram is saying is I will give you the cedars. I'll let you have the cedars. We're gonna keep the folks at home here, and you keep your folks over there. So there is a good relationship, but as Abarbanel points out, that there needs to be space which is maintained, and this seems to be what's happening over here, which makes a lot of sense. We know trust and verify. Now, when it comes to exploring this a little further, the question that I would be interested in figuring out in this relationship we've looked at is an intellectual interplay. There is a trade interplay, but I wonder, What kind of religious individual was Hiram? If we read just these psukim, what does it sound like in terms of his belief system? Just from what we're told here? I mean, he sounds like a very frum guy. Baruch Hashem! Blessed be God! Right? He sounds like a kind of person, you know? He's all right. He's all right, right? So that's what the psukim sound like they're talking about here. What was his first thing he said when he responded to Shlomo HaMelech? He says, He says, what a wonderful guy, right? So, was he a monotheist? Was he a pagan? Turns out, interestingly enough, that just history has shown, yeah, you know.
Yeah, but maybe not, because who's the last person that said Baruch Hashem in Tanakh?
I'm not sure.
Levi.
Okay, yeah, so it looks can be deceiving, right? The way we talk, it can be complicated, right? It is interesting. You're right. So it's not necessarily a proof. It's just interesting that he seems to recognize the monotheistic God of Israel. So truth be told is he wasn't so monotheistic. And you see this, actually, this is in the Ancient History Encyclopedia, in an article 10 years ago, in Source 7. Another development which encouraged the wealth of Tyre seems to be in a religious revolution in the city under the reigns of Abibal and Hiram. which elevated the god known as Melkart, a deified version of Hercules, over the traditional divine couple of the Phoenicians, Baal, known as Kel or El, and Ashtart, which is?
Asherah.
You know when we say you can't sacrifice to an Asherah? We're talking about the neighbors. This is what they were doing. The primacy of Melkart, whose name means king of the city, drew power away from the priests of the traditional pantheon of the gods and placed it at the disposal of the palace. Richard Miles notes, it seems that the desire to bring the temples to heel lay behind the royal decision to replace the traditional chief deities of Tyre with a new god. The result was not only an increase in the wealth of the palace, but through a more efficient distribution of that wealth, increased prosperity and the whole for the whole of his city, of the city. So now, it was clear that they had a pantheon. They had a whole bunch of folks up there who they were serving. So why is he not ashamed of himself when he talks to Shlomo HaMelech saying, Baruch Hashem Hayom? Ah, fantastic. That's exactly the point. You see, polytheists have less problems with monotheists than monotheists have with polytheists. It's just the way it is. Which is specifically why we can understand the conversation with Eliyahu at Har HaKarmel. What does he say to the people? He says, Ad Mosai Atem Poischim Al Shnei Asifim. How in the world can you do this? One day you're praying to Baal, which is ultimately the rain god, the god of fertility, which is going to now give all the crops. And how can you pray to Hashem the next day? In the polytheist version of reality, no problem. What I do is I pacify as many powers as possible. And if something goes wrong, I blame it on the other one. But the problem is that there's no cognitive dissonance with there being different powers. And sometimes those powers are at war with each other. So the wind god and the rain god may have a bad day with each other. And that might be why my crops didn't grow this year. But there's no problem for me to incorporate your god into my pantheon, necessarily, which is why he seems to be very accepting. The problem is that the Jews accepted the same kind of ideology. And that's why when we talk about Avodah Zarah in Tanakh, we are most normally not talking about, on a regular basis, we're not talking about rejecting Hashem. They're not rejecting Hashem. They're just hedging. They want to also, you know, we'll pay off Baal and Asherah and all the other folks as well because we think that maybe, you know what, whoever gives us the crops, it doesn't, you know, that's their perspective. That's what Eliyahu was screaming at when it came to the people. That's why when he communicates to Shlomo, he identifies Shlomo as God. To Shlomo and to us, this is the only HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the top of the totem pole and everything else, all other powers. Adonai Adonim. As we say in Mizmor Kuf Lamed Vav, God is the power of all powers, but to him, God was among. So now, among others, which now leads us to a very important question. If this is true, historically speaking, then was this a good, bad, or neutral thing for Shlomo to be doing? Okay, now, so if his neighbor is a polytheist, who lives in the north, and has his own pantheon and interests and political interests, so is this a good thing for Israel? From our text, are there any indicators as to whether this is positive, negative, or neutral? Anything which overtly stood out? I did not see anything. I didn't see anything specifically. It seems like this is a very positive groundwork which is being laid over here. It doesn't sound like these psukim per se are giving us a judgment. Tanakh sometimes describes rather than judges. That piece. It seems like everything is good at this point in time. We don't see, and that seems like it's a good thing. It is interesting, though.
They had to kick out all the other nations before they could settle the land.
Now, so actually, as just a side point to your point, Freddy Lieber, is Tyre, or the Phoenicians, one of the seven Canaanite nations? The answer is no. The Phoenicians are not one of the seven nations. Mm-hmm. And perhaps part of the reason is because they're not actually part of Canaan. They're north. Their Phoenicia is not part of... They always were a mercantile alliance with Israel, never had problems. Israel, we did kill a few of their cities in the conquest. Dan destroys
just
one of the cities.
The idea that the reason why they couldn't settle the land while they were still there was because they would learn from them. So if you're going to learn from your neighbors, then maybe you shouldn't have that.
Precisely. So what you're saying is the following. Is this is actually a pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim. We see this actually, I put this in source 8. We say, Lo sichrois lohem velehem bris. Do not make a covenant with them or their gods. They should not be in your land. They take you away against from me. You will serve their gods. Shall be for you as a trap. So that may be true, certainly of the seven nations. But if the seven nations are no longer here, and you have neighbors who are frequenting your country, the same logic would hold. Which means that now you're bringing in not just wood, but you're bringing in people with that wood who are now going to, there's going to be interaction, and that interaction may not necessarily be good. Yes?
And suppose Shlomo wasn't concerned. If they're worshipping the Asherah, maybe they worship this wood.
That's a good question. I'm not an expert in Asherah worship, but so I'm not sure if it's a specific tree or not, and how that could be verified. But it is probably likely is a good assumption that you're probably not chopping down your deity to send it as a trade item. But nonetheless, you're right. There would probably have to be some sort of verification process. So this is the question which is sort of should be in the background of our minds, and that is that with this peace, with this prosperity comes a little bit of a question should we be seeking alliances with these nations? As an example, I just want to play this forward a little bit. This is playing into the future now, just to see the complexities, because we're looking at this in the present, and we live in a very pleasant vacuum of the present, but unfortunately life carries on and it doesn't work that way. So as an example, we do see complicated relationships with the Phoenicians later on. As an example, there is a lady in Tanakh who is a Phoenician, and she's a very bad lady. Does anybody know what her name is? So her name is Jezebel. Okay, most people do not know this, but take a look in Melachim, in source 9. Vayhi anokel lechtoi b'chatos yirova minavot, vayikach isha es izevel, bas es ba'al melech tzidonim, vayelech vayavoid es aboel vayishtach uloi. Achav, who's going to be the king of Israel, one of the earlier kings of Israel, makes an alliance with Sidon. Sidon is the sister city to Tyre, under the Phoenicians, and marries the daughter of the king. The king's name is Esbaal, obviously named after the Baal god, right? So the daughter is Jezebel, which is why throughout the reign of Achav, there is tremendous idol worship in the land, because Jezebel is controlling the land, besides her corruption and how she deals with her personal matters. But in terms of national policy, she's terrible. And by the way, Achav dies a terrible death. He has his own choice, but this was a bad decision to make in the first place. If we fast forward even further into the future, as we get into the times of Yechezkel, now just to understand, we are right now at the building of the Beis HaMikdash. So we're already 4 centuries before when Yechezkel is living. Yechezkel is living during the period of the destruction of the temple in Babylon. And during the prophecies of Yechezkel, he turns sort of almost a 360 around him, and he talks to all the nations who are around him at that time. And for our purposes, it's fascinating when he turns to the Phoenicians. What does he say to the Phoenicians? He has the pasuk he says, and this is in Yechezkel Perek Chav Ches. There's a few pasukim. This is one of them. Hashem says, Ben Adam, Emor li negid tzor, tell to the king of Tyre, Koy amar Hashem lakim, Yan govali b'cho v'tomer kel oni. Since you said that I am a god, Moshav Elokim Yoshavti, that I sit on the throne of God, Belev Yamim, in the heart of the seas. Why? Because there was Tyre. It was this impenetrable island. He says, V'ata Adam v'loikel. You're a human. You're not a god. V'atitain libcho kelev Elokim. But you make yourself like God. Why does this king of Tyre think of himself so impressively? So the truth is because, according to some accounts, he had a lot of longevity. He had a really long life. Some of the Mepharshim, whether this means it literally or not, say, when David Yehuda goes to his place, he meets this person called Hira Isha Adulami. That might be the same as Hira, but that's a very long time. That's an extremely long time, so whether that means metaphorically or literally. But certainly it seems like even in the amount of time, he is the king of Tyre in the times of David, and then later on in Shlomo. And it seems like Hiram is a name which comes up a number of times in Tanakh. He seems to be his long-living king. And this longevity does get to his head. In fact, the Medrash says, this Medrash right over here, the Yalkut in Yechezkel, describes the most bizarre practice that this king had, this Hiram had. Here's what he does. Let's just see over here. Oh, Hiram Melech Tzor, just to get, we're not going to read the whole thing, but just to get a sense of just how elevated his ego was. Hiram Melech Tzor haya no'eh umisgo'eh ad mo'od. Go'eh umisgo'eh ad mo'od. He was very arrogant. Ma'asa, what did he do? Nichnas liyam, he entered the sea. Va'asa lo arba'a amudim shil barzel merubaim. He stuck down four iron posts into the bedrock. Arukim shiuram shava, at the same height. Ve'emidom zeh keneged zeh, he put them, so to speak, facing each other in a square. Va'asa shiva rekiim. He made 7 layers above these, the so to speak, this canopy above these rods. And he made a whole system what would look like lightning in between these harakia arishon osa shel zechuchis. The first level was of glass. It was 500 by 500 amma. And he made the likeness of stars and luminaries in it. Harakia sheni osa shel barzel. Av amma al elef amma v'silon shel mayim mafrish ben rishon l'sheni. And then he had an iron level. And in between the two was a cascading water which would move on the glass level, in between the glass level and the iron level. Hashlishi shel barzel. The third one was of barzel of iron. V'tak al tak amo was 500 by 500. V'silo shel mayim mafrish ben shen and shlishi. And again, there was another layer of water between them. V'avoni megul golois osa barakia shel barzel shoyer misbake im elu v'nishmaim kumor amim. And there'd be stones placed in the water of the trough of the third level. So when the waters would move, they would make this crashing sound as they hit each other. It would sound like, so to speak, the heavens, like you were hearing thunder. And it goes on. It's unbelievable. First, there would be lead. Well, you know, there was no lead checking in the city those days. There was no agents going out. And it goes on to describe all these seven levels. And he'd sit at the bottom, and he'd have this, and he would sort of make believe that he was, so to speak, in charge of all the seven celestial levels. So he was a very arrogant kind of fellow, it sounds like, at the end of his days, whether it be intellectually because of his longevity, because of his prosperity, whichever one it is, which is why, ultimately they say, unfortunately, that the punishment he's given is that he was going to be cut limb from limb by, I think it was one of the Greek kings, or Nebuchadnezzar, one of the Babylonians, is going to consume him, eat him limb by limb, literally, day by day. So he had a very unpleasant ending, at least in this prophecy. But we see a complicated character in Tanakh, whether it be the exact character or whether it be the extension of this kingdom and this type of king. Now, the reason why this is important for us is because Shlomo Melech is trading this person. Shlomo Melech is building the Beis Hamikdash with his Lebanon, with his Arizei Alevana. So is this good or bad or indifferent? So what may help us is if we fast forward a little bit into the period in Tanakh called Shivas Tzion, the return to Zion, when the second Beis Hamikdash is built. Here, let's just contrast the economic situation for a moment. Here, the country, the area of Judea is under the control of which country? Persia. The Persian Empire now controls the area. They send back a small band of Jews who are allowed to repopulate the Judean province. And so they go, you know, all 42,000 odd Jews, which is a drop in the bucket compared to world Jewry at this point in time. And they start trying to humbly restart it. They are impoverished. They're paying very heavy Persian tax. There's a very careful Persian espionage system to make sure that they're under the thumb. Most of the Jews, or the prosperous Jews, are still staying back in Babylon and Persia to where they're more comfortable. They've paid off their mortgages already. At this point in time, the Persian Jewish community in Israel, they try to rebuild the Beis Hamikdash, is not doing so well. There's assimilation. There's lack of education. They can barely speak Hebrew, in fact. Which is why Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, which lived at this critical stage, were the ones to institute the Siddur, because they found that most of the Jews living here spoke what the Tanakh tells us, Ashdodis. They spoke this Gazan dialect. They couldn't even really fully understand the Hebrew. So it's a complicated time. Very different to Shlomo, right? Now, as they come back to the land of Israel, and they're not in the economic situation parallel to Shlomo at all, here is the offer that they receive. Then we're going to skip into the 12th source, which is Ezra, Perek Dalad, Psukim Aleph to Gimel. And they find there are locals. These are not indigenous locals. These are locals who have been moved here through the exile shift of the Assyrians and later the Babylonians. But nonetheless, after a few short years, they feel like they are the indigenous inhabitants. And in fact, they want to have their own right to self-determination, and they want to create their own flag. And, you know, it sounds like history just repeating itself once again. And they come to the Jews, who really are the natural inhabitants, who've just taken a little siesta up in Babylon. And the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin here, and they hear that they're building the second temple, in the second commonwealth. This is cosmopolitan, folks. We want to have a hand in this. We may not be Jewish, but hey, why should that stand in the way? Let's all build this temple together. And we want to serve your God too. And we will sacrifice to him. By the way, you see the Kri and the Ksiv there. Just the complications of intentions again here. Yeah, no, we'll sacrifice to him. Their fingers crossed behind their back, right? That's the Kri or Ksiv, the Loi. Right? And we do sacrifice to him since the days of Eshadon, which was the king of Syria, who brought us here, because they were brought as a displaced nation. My name is Zerubbabel v'Yeshua. The two leaders, the religious leader was was Yeshua Kohen Gadol, and the political leader, the governor, was Zerubbabel. Ushaar Roshea obviously Israel, loy lochem v'loinu, livnois bais l'elokenu. Sorry, folks. This is not a joint project. Ki anachnu yachod nivne la Hashem Elokei Yisrael, kashir tzivon ha-melech koresh melech pros. We are going to, as Cyrus instructed us, we as Jews are building this, and I'm sorry you don't have a part in this, which led to political adversary, and these people were very upset with the fact that we weren't willing to be so liberal about our religious belief system. And so therefore they started sending letters back to the Persians who stopped us building, and they started let us build again, and they started attacking, and then we had to spend a lot of our GDP making sure that we had security of that while we were building. So half of the people who actually spent guarding and half the people who spent building. Sounds like things haven't changed in Jewish history. Nonetheless, there's so much to learn. You learn, say, for Ezra. Ezra is really much, very much a parallel to, or our times is a parallel to Ezra in so many ways. But nonetheless, what do you see over here? Here you have a people who are much more in economic need than Shlomo ever was. These are people who don't have sovereignty, don't have tax systems, don't have a nation. They have a small province which is governed by Jews by a nice token of friendship by the Persian Empire. And nonetheless, they say, no thank you, we don't need or want your involvement, O friends. And it costs them greatly, politically and militarily. But nonetheless, they understand that their mission is to build the Beis Elokim, to build the house of Hashem, alone, because that's their mission. This is perhaps reading history backwards. We always have 20/20 hindsight. But yes, it may have started off well, but it's complicated. When you invite in friends, there's always something that happens. There's always somebody else's agenda. People start fraternizing and get marriages start happening and alliances start happening and it becomes complicated. And that's perhaps what the Tanakh is investigating over here. Is that, yes, this was a good thing, and yes, there was peace, but we should really look at the longitudinal perspective and think about it from this perspective. And it's not like Tanakh is telling us the answer is one way or another, but it's questioning. And today even, we have to question ourselves. You know, there were Jews in the kibbutzim who believed that Russia, the USSR, was their salvation until 1967, until suddenly the Russians were supplying arms to the Arab forces. And they believed that red was the color to go. They did not believe in the Americans at the time. We have to be where we put our trust and which bastion we hide behind. Not so simple. That's why perhaps, we'll just close today with this Medrash, the Tana de Eliyahu Rabba says, Ashrehem at Tzadikim, in the last source, She'en Soinei Sholet Bohem, we do not hate those who control over them, Uvama Seyedem, She'kem Osinu B'mishkan She'yeh Osa Moshe, Sholei Sholat Bo Soinei, nobody, Moshe Rabbeinu, did not allow anybody else to get involved. No neighbors, no Sinai Bedouins were helping gather the materials. And therefore his table was not turned in his face. When it came to the tabernacle and the sanctuary that Shlomo made, Sholot Boy Soine, there were those who were hateful, there were adversaries who were involved. And that table eventually got turned on his face. Speedily in our days, as he's saying Kaddish, and Hashem will dwell in it for eternity. Why? Because we sought out pristine sovereignty without necessarily reaching out further. This is a question which I don't think has an answer, but this is a question which is worth thinking about in the expansion of our first kingdom and how much friendship and alliances are going to be something which help us or act as a thorn in our sides, as Mishpatim says. So now we are ready to start the actual building the Beis HaMikdash on a much more positive note, God willing. Thank you, folks.